America and all of our listeners all over the world. You are listening to an exciting new edition of Let's Weekend. I am your host and the most, Brandon Perkins. Joining me always is Chris Selogy. Say hi to all the folks, Chris.
Hello.
Yeah, it is officially 2022. Specifically, it's January 8th when we're recording this. Obviously, we took off Christmas break, and we also took off for the New Year's as well. Because let's be honest, none of us was going to be physically able to host this show, whether it be, you know, getting over the food coma from Christmas or the, you know, alcohol coma, I guess, from New Year's, which means that we basically went through a couple of weeks where a bunch of shit happened, some pretty consequential shit, and none of us were here to talk about it. So, what are we going to be doing this week? Well, other than the fact that, you know, we're all kind of getting back into the swing of things here, we'll, be talking about some of the stuff that's happened over the last few weeks, including some trials that ended up, having some fateful conclusions. A bunch of them as it happens. In fact, the whole, like, front of the show is front loaded with them. We also had a quartet of celebrity deaths that happened over then, including one that really hurt so bad because it literally happened not just a few days shy of her 100th birthday, but literally only a couple days before the end of 2021. In fact, I think it was literally the day before 2021. I'm in 2022, started. And then, of course, we got some entertainment stuff. And, you remember those guys that were in charge of auditing the election in Arizona, the quote-unquote cyber ninjas?
Yep.
Yeah. Some interesting things have happened with them. And, let's just say that they aren't terribly long for this world. But, we'll be getting to all that and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend. So, to start us off, Chris, how was your holiday?
It was all right.
That's good.
The fun thing is, as soon as New Year's hits, the temperatures just took a dive.
Oh, yeah. Same here. It was like Christmas Day. Christmas Day, where I was, it was like 72. You know,
yeah, here it rained all day.
Yeah. And then as soon as, New Year's happened, we had those two huge, like, fronts that came in, you know, and, you know, causing a bunch of severe weather and shit. And, yeah, it just, the temperatures just plummeted. It's like in the 30s down here right now.
Yeah. We've had a bunch of days that have been below freezing, including today, where, you know, wind chills hovering around like 9 degrees most of the day, which is real fun. Though for whatever reason, it's warming up overnight so that it can rain all morning tomorrow. So
yeah,
that's all the fun there. But then as soon as it's done with this. Tomorrow's a high of 40.
Mm-hmm.
But then as soon as that's done, it's back down to a high of 22.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just kicking us right in the nuts early and often this year. But other than that kind of stuff, I've been watching a bunch of things here over the past couple of weeks here. Let's see. I finished up Cobra Kai Season 4. Not going to spoil anything, but it is a really good season. Does some fun stuff. The only like spoilery thing that I'll say is that it leads into another tournament. The second one of the series. And it's a fun way to cap the season and all the stuff that happens in the wake of it as they set up the next season. Does some good stuff there. So I'm curious to see how things go for the next season. We'll see. But There's that, and then the new Boba Fett show for Disney Plus has started. They have two episodes now out.
Yep.
Kind of all right so far. These first two seasons kind of, you get a little bit of sort of current timeline stuff, but it's been mostly, you know, story stuff about what happened to him after, like during and after the Sarlacc Pit stuff. Mm-hmm. As you know from, I think it was the third movie, they had the whole fight outside of Jabba's palace. He falls into the Sarlacc Pit, never to be heard from again.
Mm-hmm.
And as they show here, like, he managed to find his way out.
Mm.
Gets captured, or he's, like, passed out in the desert because, you know, he's not exactly in the sort of shape to deal with that. Then he's captured by Tusken Raiders. It's sort of what's been happening over the past two episodes is showing his... Everything's going on with that.
Yeah.
Then they do show some current day stuff, things that have happened after his stint in The Mandalorian.
Yeah.
Where he's taken over Jabba's palace and intending to be the new daimyo, as they call him.
Yeah.
I found it interesting they use that term for it, because I don't think it's ever used for Jabba.
No.
The Hutt.
That's especially because daimyo is like an actual... That's like an actual thing. Like that was the name used in Japan for a feudal lord. So
yeah,
weird that they would bring that title up.
Especially because the guy that plays Boba Fett kind of pronounces it a couple different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of times where he just drops the Y.
Oh yeah,
like Daimo.
Mm-hmm.
Like just trying to roll through the YO a little too fast.
Mm-hmm.
But he's trying to settle into that role.
Mm-hmm.
Finding that maybe there are people that are fighting against that.
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly eager to let him just roll right into that. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff with that. But yeah, it's kind of a boring couple of first two episodes. Hopefully they're done with the backstory stuff. Kind of move into the current day stuff. So I don't know. It's been alright so far.
Yeah.
The other one is one of the hot new Netflix things, Don't Look Up.
Yep. The movie everybody's fucking talking about.
Yeah.
And the reason everybody's talking about, other than the fact that it's actually a good movie, is the fact that the media is trying to do its best to wash its hands of, you know, getting called out by the movie.
Yeah, it's very much like a modern Idiocracy.
Mm-hmm.
That is less naive about what it's talking about.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Idiocracy is very kind of naive and silly.
Yeah, kind of.
It handles that
stuff. A lot of people kind of get the wrong message from that movie, too. Because, and to be fair, Mike Judge doesn't really help when he front loads the movie with that whole thing about, you know, human reproduction and shit, and how, like, all the smart people, you know, they wait to have kids, and all the idiots end up overpopulating the earth, because the actual message of the movie is not about, you know, that sort of weird eugenicsy thing. It's about, you know, allowing stupid shit to become the dominant norm in any kind of culture.
Yeah. Letting society regress.
Yeah.
Instead of progressing.
Yeah.
To a point that isn't wrong about a lot there.
Mm.
But, you know, it's just not particularly making a...
And I loved how when, you know, Trump was president, everybody was, you know, comparing him to Camacho. But the funny thing is, anybody who's watched that movie will tell you, Camacho was at least smart enough to realize when he was wrong. And not only that, he was also smart enough to step aside when he found someone that was more qualified for the job.
Yeah, to denigrate things to people that knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, here in Don't Look Up, the whole thing is that this student discovers this comet that had never been seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And in relaying its discovery to her teacher,
mm-hmm.
played by Leonardo DiCaprio. They sort of start, you know, quizzing him, like, okay, what are, you know, the numbers of its course, that kind of thing, and figuring out that in about 6 months or so, it is going to hit the Earth, and it seems to be big enough to destroy everything.
Yeah.
And so they are kind of shooken up by this.
Yep.
And then contact the office about in the federal government about monitoring these near Earth objects.
Mm-hmm.
And so that leads to them kind of getting invited to the White House and a whole weird bit in this movie is that the general that they meet that is kind of their shepherd for the first day because they're waiting to go meet the president and brief them on the thing they've discovered, that kind of thing. And this general brings them drinks and snacks while they're waiting and like ask them for money for it.
Yeah.
That after they realize upon future visits to the White House that this stuff is free
because
it's the White House.
Yeah.
Being like, why did he ask us for money? Like that wouldn't, we wouldn't find out that was not how it's supposed to be done.
Yeah.
Like repeatedly she brings it up throughout the movie to other people that are also dumbfounded about why a general in the military, a high ranking general would do this.
Mm-hmm.
Beg for money essentially.
Yeah.
But then they meet the president eventually the next day, and she is basically Trump in a nutshell.
She's Trump. She's basically what happens if you take Trump and Hillary Clinton and meld them in one person.
Yeah, though Trump is very much the dominant part of
it. Yeah, obviously.
she, like, there's a whole controversy going on as they lead up into this about her Supreme Court pick, this guy that they find out has done like porn and this other kind of weird shit that's going on. And she's acknowledging what they're saying is probably true, but also being like, yeah, but it's going to affect my polling going into the midterm. So we're going to table this for a bit.
Yeah.
To which they're like, what? This is going to destroy the Earth. What are you talking about tabling it?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's that. There's the whole notion that she has mega donors that get to, you know, get access to her at any point, at any time, which brings in the notion of the super rich billionaires, tech bro billionaires that are very weird, but also their interest is not in the safety of humanity, but making money, because there's a point where they discover, like, oh, there's potentially, like, rare earth minerals on this comet. That,
worth, like, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, that they're like, okay, so we'll just create these drones that are just going to land on it, plant these explosives that are going to break it up into pieces, and we'll just capture all the pieces, to which does not work.
No, obviously.
To which he, every time, like, they're like, oh, we lost this drone, and like this drone, it's like, oh, it's fine. Everything's working as planned. Then you find out there's this whole other thing going on where he has a ship that's going to leave the Earth to look for, or to go towards one, like, near-Earth planet that is similar to Earth, and that's a whole thing there. But, yeah, there's lots of chaos. They go on to a, like, tabloidy TV show.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, we'll talk about the news. And they go on to, like, break the news about this whole thing to people. And the hosts are just constantly, you know, being glib about it and jokey and all this. And like, no, what are you talking about? We're talking about the end of the world.
Yeah. By the way, if it isn't obvious by now, the whole sort of comet thing is obviously meant to be some sort of allegory for climate change or really any kind of existential threat that nobody takes seriously.
Yeah,
like it's so obvious, it's almost on the nose. So on the nose, you might need rhinoplasty afterwards.
Yep, it's a whole essentially like lampooning of the nature that the media, the federal governments, and any government in the world, not just the U.S. government, and the tech bro billionaires that claim they can solve this problem easy peasy sort of thing have zero interest in actually saving the world when they could have done it easily ages ago.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, because it's not in their interest and it's somebody else's problem to solve.
Yep.
Kind of thing. That's kind of what this is all about. The whole the fun thing they do is that they have post credit scenes that
are
actually the most funny things.
Pretty much, yeah.
Everything else that has happened, because it's just like, oh, okay, this, yep, sure.
Yeah.
We're back at these other people.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's, it's a satire that isn't really that funny, because you're like, no, this is exactly what would happen.
Yeah, I mean, it has some funny moments, yeah, but mostly it's just infuriating.
Yeah, because Leonardo DiCaprio's basically every rational person.
Yeah.
Because he eventually goes along with the government's like PR campaign about all this, and eventually goes back on that TV show that I mentioned earlier, and it's like just having a complete meltdown, being like, no, what the fuck are you talking about? And all this, just cursing constantly.
Yeah.
All this, and comes the realization, like, no, we're fucked.
Yeah.
Because none of these people know what we should have done. Wanted to listen at any point.
Yeah. And that part with media is kind of one of the other reasons why this movie took off like it did. Because, obviously, you know, it started off sort of spreading by word of mouth. But once it became known that, like, one of the biggest targets of the movie is the media itself specifically, basically, like, all the, you know, CNN, MSNBC, yes, Fox News, and all the other ones were basically like, no, man, we're not that bad. It's like, but it's like, no, you are. Like, the reason, you know, you know, this is exactly how you've acted when it comes to the climate change issue. You know, it's just you're looking, you're at yourself in the mirror, and you've discovered you really don't like what you see.
Yeah, a way that a lot of the political media tries to make everything out to be like a two-horse race.
Yeah, or it has to be like, you know, there's like two, you know, there's a, you know, like everything has a, you know, a two different views. And it's not, man. You know, there are certain things where there is a right and a wrong answer. And because of the way that our media is organized, they have to do whatever they can to sort of make themselves try to appear as non-biased as possible, you know, unless it, you know, comes to their corporate overlords, but that's another story. But so Don't Look Up. Great movie. Go, you know, if you got Netflix, watch it.
And the title is at that point where they start really going in, where they're saying like, hey, look up, you can see the comet right there.
Yep.
And essentially the GOP there is like, no, don't look up. Don't be, don't be a, you know, tool of the liberal elite.
Yep.
Like this. Then it shows somebody like actually looking up and be like, what the fuck? What are you telling us? There's nothing up there and it's right there.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a fun, fun-ish movie. Makes its points. Hopefully it gets people to wake up. But yeah, that was kind of the big thing there. But yeah, for games, I've been playing Symphony of the Night.
Oh, nice.
Kind of got the bug to go back, and I started up a new save on the Requiem collection on PS4. And finally just did the thing and just grabbed a map off of game facts, I think, that shows me like where everything is at.
Yeah.
Instead of just fucking bumbling around and usually running into some sort of dead end somewhere and just giving up. I ended up just kind of pushing through that. So I'm nearing the end of the first map, kind of just going through and checking some of these trophies that are in there. And they have, there seemed to have been a point in the that game's development where they're like, let's just add a bunch of fucking weird one-off stuff. Because there's a trophy for trying to eat a peanut.
Yep.
Which does not work like anything else in the game. Because you're essentially like flicking it up into the air, and when it gets close to Alucard's head, you hit up on the D-pad to eat it. Which you wouldn't necessarily understand at first. And also, peanuts are just like an item that you can find in one specific part of the map. As like just, what? Who the fuck would put this in a game? Because it's, again, all the Castlevania games up to this point have nothing like anything that's in this game. There's a lot of stuff here that's just like so clearly out of the Universal Monsters theme that every other game is basically set around. That's, there's just lots of weird ass stuff here, especially and kind of the worst part of it is just the food, the way you have to equip it, like the food and the potions and that kind of stuff. You have to equip it to use it instead of it just being a use item in the menus kind of thing like you would prefer. But at that point, they probably didn't know any better. Because a lot of the food is like, oh, you equip it and then you use it, which then they throw it on the ground and then you can eat it for HP kind of thing. But then they have weird stuff like, oh, here's the shield rod that you use with various shields and they all have different effects. It's like I had the Medusa shield, which just shoots out these like rays of whatever that damage enemies just fly around and hone in on them, which is kind of game breaking in a way. There's also spells and shit, like these specific things you can do that just kind of break a lot of stuff in this game. So yeah, kind of the aside to that is I got also went and bought Bloodstained Ritual of the Nights. It's like, it's like that taken to the nth degree, just have zero interest in making a reasonable game. Just make one that is so ridiculous and at times very busted balance-wise kind of game. That just has zero interest in being, you know, a grounded experience. Because there's just so much in that game. But yeah, those are pretty fun times for what they are. Let's see. Also been playing Shovel Knight Pocket Dungeon, the newest Shovel Knight game. And this one is a roguelite puzzle game. So like the neat thing is it has, you know, you have like a camp that you come back to whenever you die. But it's pretty flexible on how you define what a failure state is, because you can set your stock from you know, first time you die, you're just done. Your run's wiped. Or you can make it infinite so that if you die, you just kind of respawn at the top of the field. You kind of work your way through. And if you, you know, fail X amount of times, you're just done on that run. So it's a little bit more flexible. I think they call it like a puzzle mode of sorts. So, yeah, you're kind of going around doing attacks on enemies, and they can they basically drop like puzzle pieces, but if they, you know, are linked together, they can, you can sort of attack one and you'll attack them all in a group. Same with getting potions to refill health, which, you know, as you maybe upgrade your health, one just fills it up a little bit, and maybe more that are linked will fill up all the way, that kind of stuff. The fun thing is they have all the knights in there that you can fight. And that's a fun little sequence that is just different from in any of the other stages. But once you beat them, they kind of show up in your camp and you can play as them. And much like in Shovel Knight, they control very differently from every from, you know, the regular Shovel Knight, the way he moves around. So like the ones I have, I think I have the King Knight and the, I forget what his name is, but the Plague Knight.
Mm-hmm.
He has this big weapon, which he takes damage if you take the poisons, but gets health off of killing enemies.
Mm.
So that's kind of a big change up there. So you kind of have to take one for the team and take the potions to get rid of them off the board. But mm-hmm. also you have to take out enemies to refill your health. So kind of, because enemies will damage you with each hit. So you're kind of having to do this back and forth kind of thing there. So yeah, it's a pretty neat little game. Definitely going to put some more time into it. So that's a nice one there. And the other one I kind of been getting into over the break is Hardspace Shipbreaker.
Mm-hmm.
This is a PC game. It's still in early access. I think their last update is 0.7. But this is a game that is kind of aggressively anti-capitalist.
Oh, yeah.
Where you are sort of somebody that is, when you start up a campaign, you're very much in debt. You show your tablet with all these emails for various things you owe money for.
Mm-hmm.
So you decide to sign up for employment at this company called the Lynx Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they go through your sign up process for that. And the fun part is the check boxes you have at the end for it says here, press agree to each statement. I have no criminal record in the Terran or Martian zones.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a member of and have never associated with a workers union or other labor interest.
Mm-hmm.
I have completed my annual medical exam and have been cleared of having McAuliffe's lung. Yeah. I have no commercial or real estate interests on Luna, in the asteroid belt, or in the nation, a state of Arizona. I will bring a positive attitude and problem-solving mindset to work every day. I understand and accept the health risk associated with long-term exposure to Van der Waals Field.
Mm-hmm.
And I will vote for Chancellor Cheng Zhang in the Pan-American Senate election.
Mm.
And then you agree to all that, and you get to go in. And the part of the process for working for them is that they take your DNA sample, which destroys your human body.
Yep.
Essentially cloning you, essentially, over and over again. And so if you die, and when you start, here's a list of all these fees, you're immediately in $1.2 billion debt to them, to this corporation. A lot of it's here's for the genetic backup storage, all this kind of stuff, and getting your new place to live out in this this station, all this kind of stuff. So you're just in immense debt, and what you're tasked with doing is they bring these decommissioned ships, spaceships, and you're tasked with breaking them apart.
Yep.
And sorting the pieces into stuff that goes into the furnace, stuff that goes into the processor, and the valuable stuff that goes into the barge.
Yeah. And the thing is, the shipbreaking is actually a fairly common occupation in the third world, and it's notoriously hazardous because they use a lot of materials making ships that are caustic and toxic to the human body. And of course, processing all that shit itself is also fairly dangerous, because you got to burn a lot of that shit.
And here you're kind of looking at these different spaceships. A lot of stuff I have right now are smaller ships, that kind of stuff. So you have two different guns. One is sort of a gun to grab pieces.
Mm-hmm.
The other is to break them apart. One has two modes in it right now. One is just sort of burning, which you use to, you'll see these black and yellow bits that hold these pieces together.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of just burn them up so they can loosen up. And so you'll do that. And here's this, tile from the side of the ship. I can now pull it out and shoot it into the right place, that kind of thing. On the there's a couple different difficulties, some that are permadeath, others that are more lenient. I started one on the regular difficulty where you have to keep refilling your oxygen every so often, maybe your fuel if it's a long enough job. And that all very much feels like, oh, here's like corporation, like, oh, we can't give you a big oxygen tank, so here's a smaller one. You keep paying us for refills, that kind of thing, to add to your tab, essentially. But then I moved over to the lower difficulty that is a bit more chill. You don't have to worry about the oxygen stuff, though. Every time I start it, gives me the option of like turning it back on if I want, which I don't really want to. But yeah, the whole thing is kind of neat. So I think the first few I've done on that difficulty had like fuel tanks in there. So I had to be very careful because you can cause an explosion, which I did my second time around because I was trying to burn a particular piece that I wasn't supposed to right then. So I did some good damage and just broke the ship, that part of the ship, into a bunch of tiny pieces that then I had to grab and shoot into the right places. Took a while just to sort through all that crap versus if I had done it right, it would just be these bigger chunks that could be sorted through more easily. That kind of thing. So yeah, it's a fun kind of chill game. They even have the concept of like flair. As you do certain tasks, you get these like stickers that you can put on your guns. It's like, I've done things, you know, like Office Space. But they have that whole concept in there of Jennifer Aniston's character having flair from working at the restaurant. The manager is all obsessed about. Well, meanwhile, she just does not give a shit about it because it's a sign of how shitty the job is. That kind of thing. And yeah, the fun thing is like, you only have, you know, you have to recomplete these different objectives to get multiple versions of the same sticker to put on there. So it's like, oh, there's like 15 different spots for stickers. Like, oh, cool.
Neat.
This is a fun further exploration of the anti-capitalist kind of attitude of this entire game. So yeah, it's been a fun little thing there. So yeah, that's been the bulk of what I've been doing. So Brandon, how about you?
Well, first, ask me if I got a PS5 for Christmas.
Did you get a PS5?
Fuck no. good news, though. I am in the process of getting an Xbox Series S. So
okay,
there is that. I just had to move some money around, but it can be done. Instead, mostly, I got a bunch of gift cards and some new clothes and some other stuff that's inconsequential. You know, it's folks have said that that they're hoping maybe they can get me the PS5 for my birthday, which is a little under a month from now. As for now, I am still PS5-less. I am hopeful that will eventually come to an end, but, well, here we are right now. But, in the meantime, what have I been playing? Well, I did get a copy of Metroid Dread for Christmas, and so I have been playing that a little bit. Nearly wanting to snap my controller in half because of those fucking unkillable robots! Yeah, I mean, it's a great Metroid game, but holy shit. There are a couple of enemies you will encounter in this game that when the whole idea is you can't kill them. They're basically these stalking menacing things that can attack you pretty much at any time, so you're always kind of on your toes, and it's kind of trying to like put a survival horror aspect into the game. But the game is, you know, it's still largely an old school Metroid game, which is fine, and I am glad that they're finally bringing that particular story arc to a close. I'm still fairly early in the game, so I'll get back with that. Also, still messing around with my PS Now subscription. I've been playing Borderlands, the pre-sequel, which I've talked about this before. It's basically Borderlands, but most of it takes place on the moon. Meaning that, there's, less gravity, so there's a lot of floaty jumping that you can do, which is cool, but you also have to make sure that you have your oxygen with you. Now, the good thing is the game doesn't really make this a huge issue to start out with. To start out with, it can be an issue because... your oxygen tank isn't really that particularly large enough to really keep a bunch of oxygen with you at any given time. But you come across bigger and bigger tanks as the game goes on, so you can get up to having like 200 oxygen or whatever. And at that point, the game, there are a lot of enemies that you come into contact with, and they all have cans of oxygen on them. So at that point, the oxygen thing doesn't really become that big of a hassle. But story-wise, basically, the pre-sequel is essentially telling the story of why Handsome Jack wants to kill the original Vault Hunters from Borderlands so badly. It basically tells you why. Handsome Jack was originally just Jack. He was just a low-level programmer for Hyperion, who basically one day decides that he's working there when it gets overrun by these guys called the Lost Legion, and their lieutenant, who is convinced that the moon has to be destroyed, because if they don't, there's this horrible thing underneath it that'll come loose and destroy Pandora and possibly the galaxy. And a lot of the game is you sort of going around the moon doing normal Borderlands things, while at the same time trying to find a way to eventually shut down like the huge laser on the Hyperion HQ, and eventually help Jack to open the vault that has the thing that he gets, that he now, has in Borderlands 2. What's funny about the actual like moon compared to Pandora is that the moon is basically Australia. It's completely dominated by people with Australian accents or the occasional British. It's hilarious, actually. All of the your common enemies in contact with on Pandora, they got new names. So like psychos are called lunatics. Raiders are called scavs, scavengers, stuff like that. It's a pretty good series. It's actually kind of harder than Borderlands 2 is. And I'm not sure if it's necessarily because of the, like, zero-G aspect of it. Well, not zero-G, but low-G aspect of it. Or, there's kind of a steep difficulty curve that comes about halfway through the game. Otherwise, pretty good. What else? Oh, yeah. I talked before about how one of my favorite manga of all time is Berserk, which... as everybody sadly probably knows, the creator of Berserk passed away last year. For those who don't know, Berserk, there's actually like these huge like hardcover editions of the Berserk series called the Berserk Deluxe that you can get. And I recently got the first copy of that, which I believe is the first 2.5 volumes in a single book. And it's actually amazing to see that artwork sort of as large as it is, because you're actually seeing it the way that, people who were originally reading, Young Animal Arashi, which was, the magazine that the manga was serialized in. This is how it originally looked when people were first reading the magazine. Kitaro Miura's artwork is gorgeous in any way, any case, but in that big of a format, it's just beautiful. But really, other than that, it's just, you know, trying to keep warm because, like we said at the top of the hour, when the frickin' fronts came in after the holidays, the weather just kind of plummeted. So yeah, it's fairly cold down here right now, you know, at least for us. But I think that's about it for that. Chris, you got anything you want to add before we move on?
Nope.
All righty then. Well then, with that out of the way, it's now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. Almost couldn't remember the title. Chris, I want to ask you, what is your earliest memory of being on the internet?
AOL chat rooms.
Okay, how old were you when that was going on?
Maybe about 10? Mid-90s?
Yeah, kind of like that. My family, we didn't really start doing the internet thing until the late 90s. Of course, by the turn of the millennium, I was chronically online, obviously. But it took us a while to sort of catch on. But, the thing about the internet is, you know, just how it sort of changed our culture in so many ways, especially when it comes to pop culture and pop cultural icons. Now, in the modern era, we, of course, have meme culture. And, you know, memes themselves have sort of evolved drastically from, like, the early memes from, like, you know, Keyboard Cat and, you know, Saxophone Guy and Chocolate Rain and, you know, all that stuff. And, man, you think about that and you're just like, God, I wish I could go back to those days before it got, you know, the meme space got corrupted by a bunch of Nazi assholes. But yeah, early meme culture was very, not just kind of quaint when you think about it. You know, all your base are belong to us. That's like probably the first meme that really took off, at least in our memory. But there was actually one meme that predated all of this. It's generally considered to be like the first major computer meme, period. And it's not only that, it's probably the one that has managed to stick around the longest and comes up in just the strangest places you can think of. Chris, do you remember the dancing baby?
Yep.
Of course you do. We all remember the fucking dancing baby. By the turn of the millennium, the dancing baby had basically spread to every corner of the fucking world. And it is generally considered to be the first major computer meme. And it is not only the first major computer meme, it is still very much around. It still shows up every so often. It's now sort of considered fairly obscure, mostly cameo, but it still shows up. And a lot of people are wondering, it's like, okay, so where the fuck did this thing come from? Why was it a baby? Why was it dancing? Why did they have that fucking song in the background? So here is what the dancing baby was. So there was a old software product that was called Character Studio that was used by a company called 3D Studio Max. Actual Character Studio, the development team, had put together a bunch of different biped animations and, you know, sort of putting them on top of these various models that they came up with. So there was like, you know, there was like regular human models. There was like a dog model. There's all these types of models. The one that we all know is called Toddler with Diaper Model VP number VP5653, which was created by a guy named John Chadwick, who was working with a company called Viewpoint Data Labs. The animation that is used on it is a kind of cha-cha dance, And when they put, you know, the whole thing of it getting it being the dance onto the baby thing was completely random. Basically, they had like, you know, they had sort of randomized all these different animations and different skins, and they were just sort of shooting the shit and finding out, you know, what one would look like. And they found the one with the dancing baby, and they were like, holy shit, this is actually kind of funny. And so what happened is that they used this. They created this particular animation to work as a sample file for Character Studio when it first went on the market. Now, at some point in 1996, a guy by the name of John Woodall, who was a web developer, took the sort of animation from that particular software, and he was putting together some demos to show how you could turn a movie into a GIF. And he took that particular GIF, and then he published it to the webpage of the internet startup that he had worked on. Everyone who would go to that webpage would see that animation. They copied it. They started putting it on their websites. It spread like insanity, and the rest is history. Most famously, it probably became super famous outside the internet because of Ally McBeal. Now, Chris, have you ever watched Ally McBeal before?
No.
Okay, Ally McBeal, it was like a late 90s,
lawyer show.
Yeah, it was a comedy, drama, a dramedy about a lawyer. It had Calista Flockhart as the star. And basically, her character is what made the sort of show unique among, you know, others of its type was that, you know, it had a kind of absurdist humor to it. The character of Ally McBeal would often sort of have these, like, hallucinatory episodes that were meant to sort of interpret her internal feelings. And one of the most common ones that everyone would see is the dancing baby, which would, of course, be always accompanied by Blue Suede's cover of Hooked on a Feeling, a.k.a. the one where they start the movie with Ooga Chaka, Ooga, Ooga, Ooga Chaka. If you've watched Guardians of the Galaxy, you've also heard this song. And after that, it started showing up in music videos. It showed up in commercials. And here's the thing. It's not only still showing up, it's actually been updated technologically. Back in 2020, there was a guy on Twitter named J. Armstrong Artie who managed to rediscover the original Dancing Baby file and then converted the original animation into high definition. So now we have the Dancing Baby in HD. And from there, you know, the whole thing just sort of started showing up just everywhere. It showed up in commercials. It was in a Blockbuster commercial. It showed up on Celebrity Deathmatch. There were references to it on TV shows like Chowder. A couple of years ago, it even showed up on Amazing World of Gumball, funny enough. That's where the dancing baby came from. And for better or worse, that fucking model basically gave birth to meme culture as we know it, at least as far as the internet is concerned. And that is another edition of Brandon's Random Factoid. So yeah, awesome. Okay, so moving on from there, we're moving on to the show proper. And as always with the show proper, we have to start with the assholes of the week. And this time it's going to be for the past couple of weeks or past few weeks because, again, we were kind of gone for a little while. And, let's just say a bunch of assholes got what they deserved. First and foremost, probably the biggest asshole of the whole group, Ghislaine Maxwell, was found guilty on 5 of 6 counts of sex trafficking of minors.
Yep. Yeah, they all center around sex trafficking of minors. She was acquitted of enticing a minor to travel with intent to engage in illegal sexual activity. And partly is dealing with this because her partner for a long time, Jeffrey Epstein, died in the process of dealing with the the fallout of all the shit he has done over many years.
Mm-hmm.
But she was there helping him out throughout much of it.
Yep.
And yeah, she has been denying any role
yeah.
in any of this stuff, but is facing up to 65 years behind bars,
mm-hmm.
including a maximum of 40 years in prison for sex trafficking of minors,
mm-hmm.
The most serious count on which she was convicted. Also convicted of a conspiracy to entice a minor to travel to engage in illegal sex acts, conspiracy to transport a minor with the intent to engage in criminal sexual activity,
mm-hmm.
transporting a minor with the intent to engage in criminal sexual activity, a conspiracy to commit sex trafficking of minors. And no sentencing date just yet. But yeah, this has been a long time coming.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was the big one.
Mm-hmm, that was the big one. But it didn't stop there, because Kim Potter, the former Minneapolis cop who famously broke into the house of Dante Wright and shot him to death, was also found guilty of manslaughter this week.
Yep. Let's see. She is found guilty of first degree and second degree manslaughter, faces mm-hmm. about 7 years in prison under the state sentencing guidelines, but prosecutors say they would seek a longer term.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's been taken into custody, held without bail, pending sentencing on February 18th.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that had been free on a $100,000 bond posted the day last April mm-hmm. that she was charged.
Mm-hmm.
Which was 3 days after she killed Wright and a day after she quit the police force.
Mm-hmm.
I think a message that was sort of echoed here, that they believe that she did this as a mistake, but that she should still be held
mm-hmm.
accountable for the consequences of what she did.
Mm-hmm.
And she probably didn't mean to, I don't know, do what she was doing
mm-hmm.
to him, but she did it. She has mm-hmm. to be held accountable for it.
Yeah. And then next up, in corporate bullshit, CEO of Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes, found guilty of fraud and conspiracy. Now, for those who are wondering what Theranos was, it was supposed to be this revolutionary health tech company that said that they could produce the equipment for blood tests that would require less amounts of blood than usual and with faster results. And it was also started by Elizabeth Holmes, who was 19 at the time, so she was sort of seen as this wunderkind of modern business. And, yeah. Of course, it ended up that the whole thing was bullshit.
Yep. Let's see. Convicted her on 3 counts of wire fraud, 1 count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud. Was acquitted on 4 other counts of fraud and conspiracy that alleged she deceived patients who paid for Theranos' blood tests, too. Mm-hmm. That she deceived patients, yeah, who paid for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of wild things. Like, all the stuff she was convicted on involved deceiving rich people.
Mm-hmm.
The things she was acquitted for were for deceiving poor people.
Yep.
But yeah, this, hopefully, she's facing up to 20 years in prison for each count.
Yeah.
Legal experts say she is unlikely to receive the maximum sentence. And hopefully it's is a sign of things to come for dealing with the bullshit that happens in Silicon Valley.
Yes, please. Because there is way too much of this shit happening.
Yep.
And then finally, and this was definitely good news from my neck of the woods, all 3 Georgia men that were convicted of the death of Ahmaud Arbery were sentenced to life in prison. 2 without the possibility of parole, and 1 with the possibility of parole.
Yep. Yeah, the third one could seek parole after 30 years in prison.
Mm-hmm.
The minimum sentence allowed for murder under Georgia law. So yeah, that's deserving for what those 3 did.
Yeah. And the only reason the 1 guy got possibility of parole is because he actually seemed to show a slight bit of remorse for what he did.
Yeah.
Whereas the other 2 couldn't care less. So.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, for some heroes of the week, because we actually had some good shit happen. And this is sort of one of those things where it's like, you know, random act of kindness. There was a hockey fan who was at a game, and he noticed that one of the team employees that was nearby had an odd-looking mole on his neck. Now, he alerted him to it, and he said, "Yo, dude, you got a kind of a that mole on the back of your neck? It's like irregular. You might want to get that checked out." So the dude went and got it checked out, and guess what? Turns out it was cancerous.
Yeah, so she was a fan at the first ever home game for the Seattle Kraken against the Vancouver Canucks. She had been sitting behind the bench area for the Canucks.
Yep.
Saw this dude named Brian Hamilton. She had been, she had been a resident. She was a 2019 University of Washington graduate, planning to start medical school this fall, had been volunteering in hospitals, and recognized that this mole looked suspicious, wanting to warn him of, but was unsure how to do so. So she typed a note in large font on her phone, pressed it against the glass, saying, "The mole on your on the back of your neck is possibly cancerous. Please go see a doctor." While he initially didn't think much of it, he asked his wife to take a look the next morning. She noted its weird shape. Team physicians also didn't like the look of the mole.
Yeah.
And within days, a biopsy revealed malignant melanoma in situ too, meaning the cancer was only on the other layer, on the outer layer of the skin. It was detected before it could become even more dangerous. Let's see, as he said, "She didn't take me out of a burning car like the big stores, but she took me out of a slow fire." And the words out of the doctor's mouth were, "If I ignored that for 4 to 5 years, I wouldn't be here." So, yeah, that's a very nice thing that she did for him.
Yeah. For any of you out there who are curious or like, okay, what does a regular mole versus a cancerous mole, what's the signs? Generally, a cancerous mole will usually be oddly shaped. And by oddly shaped, I don't mean like it'll be like a circle and it'll be kind of lumpy. I mean, like, it'll be like like a blob, basically. Also, it'll typically be of, like, different hues, sometimes even different colors inside of it. So if you find one of those on your person and it's, you know, looks, you know, it looks big and it looks blobby and it's different colors, yeah, it's generally a good idea to go get that looked at, because it might be the sign of something a lot more serious. But yeah, and here's a good one. The governor of Louisiana posthumously pardoned Homer Plessy of the famous case Plessy versus Ferguson.
Yep. 126 years after the separate but equal ruling, he has finally been pardoned. He was arrested for refusing to leave a whites-only railroad car in 1892. That led to the Supreme Court ruling that cemented separate but equal into U.S. law for half a century. The State Board of Pardons in November recommended the pardon for Plessy, who boarded the rail car as a member of a small civil rights group. Overturned a law segregating trains. Instead, the protests led to the 1896 ruling known as Plessy versus Ferguson. Which solidified whites-only spaces in public accommodations such as transportation, hotels, and schools for decades. Yeah, Governor John Bel Edwards said he was beyond grateful to help restore Plessy's legacy of the rightness of his cause, undefiled by the wrongness of his conviction.
Yeah. For the this is the Plessy v. Ferguson is where the phrase "separate but equal" came from. And as it was the show in practice, that was not how it worked. Like, at all. So.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good step. You know, I wish it had come earlier, but there you go.
Yep.
Anyway. All right. So, moving on from there, we're now going to the proper, show proper. And get ready, folks, because we got a few celebrity deaths to go through. They kind of clustered together these last couple weeks. So the first one is, of course, John Madden. Now, of course, he was an individual who was famous to multiple generations of people. To one generation of football fans, he was the coach. He was one of the greatest coaches the game ever had.
Yep.
To a second generation of football fans, he was one of the most popular and colorful commentators that the sport ever had, with a very imitatable voice and mannerisms that made him very much an icon. And finally, for another generation, he was the man who gave his namesake to arguably the second biggest sports video game franchise after FIFA.
Yeah, probably the first big sports franchise.
Yeah.
In video games.
Yeah, I know that there were previous games like Tecmo Bowl that came out before. Yeah. But
they only had a couple games.
Yeah, but the Madden series nailed it.
Yeah. So he is the winningest coach of all time that has coached at least 100 games.
Mm-hmm. And didn't lose a single one, I believe.
No, he's won. Lost games.
Well, he did lose games, but I know that when he was a coach for, what was it, the Raiders, I think?
Yep.
He basically had a win streak that lasted as long as he was coaching. So,
I don't know about that. He was 103, 32, and 7.
Yeah. The point is, he won an ass load of games. That's the point.
Yeah. He won a Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Then sort of moved over. He only coached for 10 years, which is wild.
Yeah.
Moved over into doing endorsements and all that kind of stuff. One of the most prolific in that, despite not necessarily being what you might call a handsome man, in the ways at least the you would see on TV at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Very much looked like a normal dude.
Yeah.
He, you know, tough acting, tin acting.
Yep.
Did advertisements for all sorts of stuff.
Yep.
But then he moved over to calling games.
Yeah.
Had a fun style to him because pretty much the thing I saw a lot of people talking about is how he always wanted to teach people about the sport of football. And he had a fun way of doing it without necessarily being condescending or talking down to people. He
was like a big kid, basically. Yeah. Like,
he wanted everybody to love the game like he did.
Yeah. And of course, everyone knew because the one thing he really fucking loved about being a commentator was he got access to the drawing pad.
Yeah. He loved seeing the fun side of the game.
Yeah.
A lot of people been posting clips, things of him talking about, like, or some like Dallas Cowboy games where he's like, they say that, you know, Troy Aikman's trying to grow a beard, but I don't really see it here. And it's like, drawing on there, like trying to highlight like where it's supposed to be. He's like,
yeah,
I don't think he's one that's going to be able to grow a beard. That kind of thing. And then there's another video of one of the, I think, the defensive linemen who's bald headed but playing in the playoffs, you know, in January. He's like, see, he's working so hard here. It's just steam coming off his head. Probably cooking egg on that head there.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing.
Yeah. And then, of course, he developed that adorable obsession with Brett Favre that became just one of his famous character traits.
Yeah. And from what I've read, he seemed to be very much a nice dude who was very interested in just learning. So if he was at a restaurant, he wanted to talk to the head chef and learn about the way he did things, learn, you know, as much as they could from people that were masters of their own craft, sort of the way he was master of his craft.
Oh, yeah.
And very much made an impact on the video game world.
Yeah.
He was very adamant that if EA was going to make a football game in his name, that it had to be real football. It had to be 11-on-11.
Yeah.
Football, because if you take a look at any of those old games, even Tecmo Bowl and all that, they don't have full 22 players on the field. They had actual plays. He gave them his old playbooks in those early days and eventually grew to the point where they had, you know, as many different playbooks for every team,
mm-hmm.
that kind of stuff, to where it's, very complicated at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff. But, called those games, did the recording for that stuff when they could on the Super Nintendo, that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Provided a lot of fun there. Up to the point, to think about maybe 10 to 15 years ago, where he just wasn't in there as much because he just gotten that old and not had retired from calling games and all that. And
yep.
Passed away here a few weeks ago at the age of 85.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, he got out. He got to see the finished whatever documentary that was about him,
mm-hmm.
and his career and all that. I think they re-aired it, but you can probably find it elsewhere on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to check it out and learn more about him. When mm-hmm. I heard, like, after he retired, he was just, like, calling to local radio stations at in the Bay, San Francisco
Oh,
Bay.
Oh, yeah.
Just, like, talk to his favorite radio stations about stuff. Mm-hmm. That's just what you like to do.
And then next up, and boy, this one really fucking hurt. Betty White passed away at the age of 99. She was literally only like 17 days away from becoming 100 years old.
There were definitely some celebrations.
Oh, yeah.
About to hit.
Yeah.
Made the cover of, I forget which magazine she was going to be cover on.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe People.
Yeah.
Something like that for. Luckily, before she went, she got to hear lots of love as stuff was happening. So, and she's very much one of those iconic actors that maybe never had the industry defining roles, but mm-hmm. she very much a person that left a mark. Girl,
mostly just her personality is what.
Yeah, she was always interested in funny people, working with funny people.
Yeah.
Even in an era where maybe certain people were not allowed to be on TV, like when she was younger and wanted to have, black people on.
Yeah.
That were funny. Wanted to be
also, on. Take a look at some pictures of her when she was younger. She was a fox. Like.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah, she helped out in World War II.
Yeah.
In a women's group
mm-hmm.
that they would have there. But even more recently, she had some good shows like Hot in Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. So, yeah, she's been an icon and just seeming all around a nice person.
Oh, yeah.
Seems like she just passed away of old age.
It's just like, she was good. She was 99. Her body just like, time to clock out. But yeah, it was most people, I think, especially my generation and younger, probably remembers her from being on Golden Girls.
Yeah, and look up a clip of her where she is ad-libbing, talking about a, what was it, the Herring War?
Yeah.
That's, you can see B. Arthur and Rue McClanahan are just fucking trying not to bust.
Uh-huh.
But failing to do so. She's just going on about this war.
Yeah.
About these fish and all this
ridiculous
shit.
Yeah. Because remember the whole thing about her character is that she was from St. Olaf, which was basically a town that was made up mostly of, like, Norwegian and, like, Swedish expats, and it was just... And then from there, we ended up, unfortunately, having to say goodbye to Sidney Poitier, one of the greatest actors of stage, screen, and television.
Yep.
He was very much one of the great pioneering African-American actors to make it really big.
Yep. Broke a lot of barriers.
Oh, yeah. And he was also just a damn good actor. I mean, there's really no other way to put it.
In a time that probably predates where we've seen most of his stuff.
Uh-huh.
Because he was in, like, the 50s and 60s as, the civil rights stuff was going down.
Yeah. It's not that he never stopped working. He stepped, you know, he retired, you know, about a decade or so ago, but he did, you know, he was still doing stuff well into his old age. It's just,
yeah,
most of his big successes were long before our time, but yeah, probably his most famous role is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And obviously he did a bunch of stuff, but that one in particular is the one that really cements into people's mind because it's specifically about an interracial couple. And sort of like the idea of like, you know, her liberal parents are like, yeah, we're okay with it. But then once, you know, he's actually in their home, you know, eating at their dinner table, they realize how unliberal they actually are, you know. But yeah, he did a bunch of amazing films. Yeah, I'm actually, yeah, how old was he, by the way?
94.
Yeah, damn. He lived a good long life. Wow. And finally, we had Joan Didion, the one of the very who was one of the great writers. Let's see, just she was fairly you know, prolific. She was known for having this sort of what they call electric anxiety. But yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, she died at age 87 from Parkinson's disease.
Yep.
Made her sort of breakout work in the 60s.
Yep.
Yeah, writing about just California in magazines.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Eventually grew to write about nonfiction, fiction, films, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of one of the, maybe not one of the big names. So much, but definitely one that made a lot of big marks on the writing scene.
Yep.
She wrote screenplays,
mm-hmm.
stuff like the Barbara Streisand remake of A Star Is Born.
Yep. So oh, yeah.
Panic in the Needle Park.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of stuff there. So, yeah, she's been around, did a lot of different things.
Oh, yeah.
I definitely saw her name pop up a lot because there's been a lot of discourse on the internet about J.K. Mm-hmm. Rowling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, she's the best female writer in the last 100 years. And people just start bringing up dozens of other names.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, Joan Didion was brought up amongst others.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, people that are, like, whatever, J.K. Rowling pushers on the internet... seem to stop reading once they
wrote. It's like, read another goddamn book, please.
Like, stop. Don't stop your reading career at young adult fiction.
Yeah.
Like that. Unless you're gonna stop talking about things definitively like that.
Yeah.
It's like, read what you want, but don't act like you know about writers.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be like, is J.K. Rowling the most influential writer of all time? It's like, no, shut the fuck
up. No. You know, just off the top of my head, fucking Virginia Woolf. You know, fucking Jane Austen, you know? Like,
yeah.
There's a road to note, you know? It's like, ugh.
Yeah, it's like, the thing I was just looking at is like part of J.K. Rowling's clout and acclaim resides in the fact that a lot of adults stop reading books for adults.
Mm-hmm.
When they say she's a great writer, they're comparing her to like R.L. Stine and Anne M. Martin.
Yeah.
And somebody responds, not quite. Rowling's real importance lies in the fact that she was the first writer to present a world in which class and wealth mattered. Some characters were poor, some were rich. Being poor was a hardship, not just a cheery sentimental thing in the scenery.
Like, did you not read Charles Dickens when?
Yeah, then somebody responded with a meme of her and, I assume, Marx.
Uh-huh.
I just photoshopped them onto the bodies of these teenage girls.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, moving on from there, folks. And, yep, here we go. First show of the year, and you guessed it. Beep, beep. We're opening up the garage door and backing out the COVID-19 dump truck. Now, We don't really have anything like super significant as far as like the actual disease goes. Obviously, Omicron has basically, Omicron is basically the dominant strain now, and it has gone to basically dominate the entire disease at this point.
It's everywhere.
Yeah, Delta is still kind of around in bits and places, but Omicron is so contagious that it will indefinitely overtake it within a very, if it hasn't already, it will within a very short amount of time. And I'm going to be completely honest, at this point, you should short of so much not plan on, as far as like planning goes, you should not plan on, you should change your plans from completely avoiding COVID to preparing to when you probably will get it. Because at this point, it's damn near impossible to avoid it.
Which is a stupid place to be at because...
Yeah.
Long COVID looks like an awful chronic illness to be getting.
Yeah. But unfortunately, it looks like if you have not gotten COVID at this point, then there is a good 8 to 10 chance that you're probably going to get it in the near future.
You're just setting new records all the time for.
But as far as vaccination rates go, at this moment, and this is going all the way up to yesterday. In the United States, 75% of the population has received at least one dose of the vaccine. And considering the current definitions, about 63% of the population has been fully vaccinated. Now, with Omicron, in order to get permanently vaccinated, to get like genuinely vaccinated against it, you're pretty much going to have to get 3 shots. And even then, your protection is still not as strong as it would have been against Delta.
We're about to hit 60 million total cases.
Yeah.
U.S.
Yeah. Now, the good news is the hospitalization and death rates, fortunately, are not quite as bad as it was this time last year. The problem, though, is that because of the sort of rate of vaccination as far as age groups goes, it's really targeting like kids and young adults really furiously. Now, the good news is most kids, their immune systems are pretty strong. And most of the time they will get, the disease that they will end up exhibiting is fairly mild. But again, long COVID sucks, and it can manifest itself in ways you can't predict.
I've seen people just like, oh yeah, all the good food now tastes like shit now. Like, literally tastes like shit.
I wonder. Although, the funny thing is, anosmia is actually not as good of a signifier anymore as it was with the previous ones, because... With Omicron, you can still keep your sense of smell and taste and still have it, and still have the disease.
Yeah.
Just to have all the other symptoms, which are already kind of suck, The irony, though, is obviously it sucks that it's gotten to this point that, we all sort of have to admit to ourselves that, all right, fuck it. At this point, I'm probably going to get it. Ironically, at the same time, we kind of want this particular variant to spread because it'll eventually get rid of the Delta variant, which was far deadlier. And it will also, create herd immunity. So we're in this weird kind of catch-22 where, at the one hand, we don't want this thing to spread any worse than it already is. And yet, at the same time, we kind of want it to. So, yeah, it's just that the whole, it's a 20-sided die of bullshit, basically. But anyway, as far as the stories we got for the dump truck, the first one is the FDA has officially authorized Pfizer's COVID treatment pill, which we've been talking about that before. Essentially, this was the pill that was meant to treat symptoms so it would prevent, as you know, it would be able to bring down hospitalizations.
Yeah. It'll hopefully help people head off the worst effects of the virus.
Yeah.
At home instead of going into the hospital.
Yep.
Yeah. Faster way to treat early COVID-19 infections, though initial supplies will be extremely limited.
Obviously.
All the previously authorized drugs against the disease require an IV or an injection.
Mm-hmm.
This is a sort of getting away from that. Yeah. It says like a nearly 90% reduction in hospitalizations and deaths among patients.
Yeah.
Most likely a severe disease.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously it's limited, but it's still going to have a pretty good, a pretty obvious effect, as soon as they can start, shoveling these things out there. But, they've only got so much material to work with at any given time. And fortunately, it's not the only pill that's going to be out there, because the FDA also authorized Merck's COVID pill for high-risk adult patients.
Yep.
Which this is especially good, because these are for people who were like, elderly and, immunosuppressed, individuals. So,
yeah,
definitely good.
This one's maybe one that is not as super effective. That's why they're limiting it to people that are high risk individuals.
Yep.
They're planning to get about 250,000 courses of these out in the next month or so.
Mm-hmm.
So that is hopefully going to be good news for those people.
Yeah. These two pills working in tandem, I think they're a fairly good impact, I think. And then on top of all that, the FDA also authorized the Pfizer booster for children age 12 to 15. So
yep.
We've also got that.
Yep. So that'll be good for those kids.
Uh-huh.
And as well as the third dose for immunocompromised children from 5 to 11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finally, we got some news from the CDC. For those who don't remember, there was this a recommendation of amount of time you need between getting what was the recommendation for specifically? It escapes me.
6 months.
Yeah, it was the CDC cut Pfizer recommendation time for 6 to 5 months. Same for Moderna. What was the recommendation specifically for, though?
The boosters.
The boosters. All right. That's what was tripping me up. Yeah. So originally they'd had it so that, they said you should probably wait until half a year until you get the booster for whichever, two shot vaccine you got. But now they've sort of cut it by a month.
Yeah, which is good.
Yeah, definitely good.
Be interesting to see what the plan is here throughout this year.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know how much we're going to be able to keep the booster shot thing going.
Yeah.
You're going to have to get that twice a year.
Goddamn. Yeah, well, anyway. There we go. That is the COVID-19 dump truck for this week. We're going to go ahead and back it up and close the garage door. Meet us again next week. We will probably have another one to talk about, almost certainly, because that is just the world we fucking live in right now. So far, 2022, we've only been in it a few days, and it doesn't seem quite as bad as 2021 was, but then again, 2021 also didn't seem quite as bad as 2020 did. So, yeah. Anyway. All right. So moving on from there, we're getting on to the rest of the stories for this week. Cyber Ninjas. Now, those of you who remember that name, you'll remember them. They were the company that was tasked with overseeing the auditing of the Arizona presidential election. They had no history in any of the in this field of any kind. They were basically sort of just bought out of thin air into the fold to do it. And not only, and of course, as everybody figured out, they didn't find shit. obviously.
Yeah.
And the end story of their story arc is that they are officially shutting down operations.
Yep, because they are in massive debt.
Mm-hmm.
As a judge in Arizona's Maricopa County held the company in contempt in order to pay $50,000 per day in sanctions for failing to provide records related to the so-called audit to the Arizona Republic.
Yep.
And they said their decision to shut down was well before that ruling.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever, it's saying something like there's a $2 million debt they have, as well as complaining about endless legal and character attacks on the company by those who opposed the audit. Mm. Make it untenable moving forward, which is like, yeah, because it was a load of shit from the start.
Yep.
And let's see. Officials in Maricopa County this week released a detailed rebuttal of the claims the Cyber Ninjas made, casting doubt on the validity of the ballots. After assessing the Cyber Ninjas' findings, county officials concluded that 76 of their 77 complaints were false or misleading.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't really accomplish anything.
Mm.
Except running themselves out of business.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much. I mean, let's be honest, we knew that whole thing was going to be a shit show from the very beginning, and there was really no way to go down. These idiots bit off far more than they could chew, and basically made themselves look like fools in the process, so...
Yeah, fools. From a company called Cyber Ninjas.
Like, yeah. But,
coming from a mile away.
Yep. But, moving on from there, yeah, this was definitely, like, a big story this last week. I-95 in Virginia, you know, on the interstate, they got hit with a really nasty winter storm that ended up stranding just a god-awful number of people on I-95, making one of the most nasty traffic jams in American history.
Yeah, particularly because there were a number of trailers that just got into accidents because, from what I've seen, they had the early part of this storm was happening when it was, you know, it had been 60 degrees on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the early snow just melted, and then the temperatures yep. plunged and froze that into ice under all yep. the snow. So vehicles that are susceptible to that just completely fucked up.
Yep.
Trapped all these people on I-95.
Mm-hmm.
For people that don't know, this is an interstate highway that goes from most of the East Coast. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of people, you know, trying to come into Virginia or D.C. or Maryland yep. from, you know, the South. People from the North, famously. Senator Tim Kaine was in the process of driving into D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Was stuck on the road here for about 25 hours.
Yep.
Along with many other people. And for whatever reason, the Virginia Governor Northam just didn't seem to be interested in doing much for these people.
Mm-hmm.
Like having the National Guard get into maybe, you know, treat the roads, get snow plows out there, get people food and water and gas if they need it.
Pull Start up, throwing tow. Some fucking salt on that ice, maybe, you know?
Yeah, towing people out.
Maybe just give some snow chains or something, but yeah. No.
But he's out pretty soon because the GOP candidate is taking over pretty soon. And
mm-hmm.
So it's not really too much that he seems to be interested in doing.
Yeah.
At this point. So, yeah, just kind of a whole shit show. Luckily, yeah. I don't think there were any, like, deaths out of this.
I don't think so. I do know that there were some medical emergencies. And you gotta also remember, this is in freezing temperatures. So these people were basically trapped in their cars for over a day and with very little food or anything to drink. And basically having to get behind their car door and do their open. Like, fucking sucks, man. But then moving on from there, we got some science news. Firstly, among them, there was a newly discovered fossil site in Australia that actually gives us a good glimpse at what Australia's past was like.
This is in New South Wales in Australia. Mm-hmm. Yep. They discovered this well-preserved fossil site that seems to cover the Miocene epoch. About 11 to 16 million years ago, that showed that in Australia there was like an abundant rainforest ecosystem going on. Finding fossilized spiders, cicadas, wasps, plants, fish, all that kind of stuff. Let's see. The Miocene was the point in time when most of the modern Australian environments were established, and so this fossil site is really Australia's origin story. During the Miocene, reduced precipitation caused rainforests around the world to shrink, leading to increasingly arid landscapes. The site named McGrath's Flat, located in the central tablelands near the town of Gulgong, was discovered by a local farmer who found fossilized leaves in one of his fields. There's a bunch of stuff there. Let's see, for example, melanosomes discovered in a fossilized feather mean that scientists can determine the feather's color. In case they believe it was a dark brown to black. The site formed from iron-rich rock was destined to be regarded as a Lagerstätte, a German term for paleontologists used to describe an exceptional site with many perfectly preserved fossils. Plants and creatures are fossilized when iron-rich groundwater drained into a billabong or water hole. Let's see. And the particular scientist we're talking to here says his favorite fossil here was a type of spider, it's the most well-preserved spider fossil ever found in Australia. So yeah, some good stuff there.
Oh yeah, neat stuff. So you remember back when there was that photo of the moon that seemed to show like this mysterious cube that was on there? And people were like, oh my god, what is that supposed to be? It was a rock. It was just a rock. Yeah. An interesting rock, but a rock nonetheless.
Yeah, it's not an alien monument or space cube or something, or the Transformers or whatever.
Yeah,
it's just a rock.
Yeah, and I mean, even from the picture, you could tell that it was probably what it was.
That's all that's up there is rocks.
Yeah,
rocks from the and dust.
Rocks and dust, and of course that, you know, that. Those old lunar lander things that are probably still up there somewhere.
And some water, bits of water.
And I think a couple of old flags as well. But that's pretty much all that's up there. So, no, unfortunately, you did not find any kind of alien monument or anything. One day, though. One day. But. And moving on from there, we now got some entertainment news, and we got news from Netflix that they are working on a Scott Pilgrim anime series, and I'm thinking, god damn, it took. I am surprised they haven't done this yet, but here we go.
Yep. This show's being produced by UCP. Brian Lee O'Malley is writing and executive producing this anime version.
Ah, good.
Along with Ben David Grabinski.
Mm-hmm.
Science Saru will provide the animation. So they're Edgar Wright, who's fine. Yeah, Edgar Wright, who, you know, made the Scott Pilgrim vs. the World movie, is executive producing this along with a bunch of other people.
Yep.
But yeah, this makes a lot of sense.
I mean, the original comic is like extremely anime-esque anyway.
Yeah. Sort of half video game, half anime.
Yeah. So honestly, I'm just kind of surprised that they only decided to do this now. I am happy, though, that O'Malley himself is, like, taking charge in the project. So,
yeah, you know. Yeah, he hasn't really gained much from the other stuff they've done.
Yeah.
I think specifically the game, people would ask him about that, and he's like, I didn't get any money for this.
No. I guess he got some money from the movie, but
yeah. yeah, that'll be fun to see whenever that happens.
Yep. And finally, Pixar's Turning Red will skip theaters completely for a Disney Plus debut on March 11th.
Yep, that's the new Pixar movie that features a girl that turns into a red panda when she gets mad.
Takes place in Canada, too. Which, yeah, if you only, the one sign you get from that is when the beginning, when, you know, the mom's putting the 10 bits in her kanji. So, yeah.
Yeah, that seems like a good idea because, you know, the Pixar movies are especially like family oriented movies, and they're probably not going to the theaters as much.
Nope.
These days. So, and even they're avoiding to do the Disney Plus premiere thing and charging $30 for them.
Yep.
So that is kind of a smart move to make that they didn't necessarily make much of in the past year or so when they threw out what Raya, the dragon movie out there. And I forget what the other stuff they threw out there, but I think they put Encanto on there over the holidays. That seems to be really good from what I've heard.
And it did really well too.
Yeah.
So
yeah, Luca is the other one that's like Pixar also put up on the platform. It's like, now for these people that are dealing with a lot of shit with the whole school situation, just kind of imploding in lots of places. Just make it easier for families to sit down and watch this stuff. Because you're Disney, you can deal with any sort of missed funding out of that. They say the Lightyear movie is still planning to release in theaters this summer.
Yep.
So we'll see if that stays. But at least for now, in March, you can watch Turning Red.
All right. Okay, I think we got a show, don't we?
Yep.
Yes, we got ourselves a show. Awesome. First show done for the year. So, with that, I would like to remind all of our listeners, if you got a question, comment, or something you want us to read on the air, you can get in touch with us at letsweekenders.com. That's at gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got a link for you in the show notes. I'll repeat it one more time, letsweekenders@gmail.com. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans at Google Play, RSS, archive.org, or pretty much any kind of podcast aggregator you can think of. And, yeah, so that's going to wrap it up for us starting here at the very beginning of 2022. I am, honestly, I'm optimistic for this year, but I've been proven wrong before, so... we will just go and see how this shit goes. I'm hoping, honestly, that by this time next year, this pandemic will have become endemic and mostly be behind us. But unfortunately, I've had way too much faith in the human race before. And, well, look what it got us. So, anyway, we're going to go ahead and sign off here. I have been your host with Rand Perkins. For Chris Elogi, I would like to say good night, sleep tight, and if you have yet to get vaccinated, please get vaccinated, and if you feel like you need to get a booster, please do not hesitate to get the booster. Good night, everybody.